Welcome to the Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, a former public servant, relentlessly curious person. One of the unique privileges of my life and career has been meeting so many fascinating people who've dedicated some portion of their own lives to public service. I want to know why. I really want to understand who they are, what shaped them, and what they've learned along the way. This is a tumultuous time for our federal workforce, and I think public servants are often misunderstood. This isn't about careers and resumes. It's about the messy and real lives of the human beings who have had the privilege and responsibility of serving our country. Today, I'm sitting down with Ambassador Chris Liu. During his more than 20 years of public service, Chris has worked in all three branches of the federal government. Most recently, from 2022 to 2025, Chris served as U.S. Ambassador to the UN for Management and Reform. His previous roles include U.S. Deputy Secretary of Labor, White House Cabinet Secretary and Assistant to President Barack Obama, and Executive Director of the Obama-Biden Transition Planning Efforts. Chris is the proud son of immigrants and one of the highest-ranking Asian Americans ever to have served in the federal government. Chris, thank you so much for sitting down with me today. We had the opportunity to work together when I was at the State Department, and I have long admired your steady leadership and your unfailing kindness. So I'm really happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Kate. It's an honor.
If you wouldn't mind, why don't you start by telling me a little bit about your family and your upbringing? I'm curious what mattered most in your home and how those values shaped your own vision for your career and life.
Well, as you said in the introduction, I am the proud son of immigrants. My parents emigrated first from China to Taiwan and then Taiwan to the United States, both to attend college. They settled in the Washington, D.C. area in Rockville, Maryland. And when I was 8 years old, my father took me to Capitol Hill to meet our member of Congress. Well, we just went to his office, and he actually came out, shook my hand, took a photo with us, gave us an autograph. And really, that kind of planted the seeds for my love of politics. My father was also a career civil servant. He worked at the Department of Defense. My dad really believed that there was no better way for an immigrant to give back to the country that had adopted him than by serving in government. So from a very, very early age, politics, government were really ingrained in my life. I still joke, the summer after I graduated from high school, instead of doing the typical things that kids do before they go to college, my dad made me apply for a federal government job for the summer. I had to fill out one of the SF-171s. Back in the day, you actually had to type it on this weird green piece of paper. And so I got a job as a GS-2 clerk typist at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. I tell that story because a lot of people are like, I didn't even know we still had GS-2s. And, you know, Kate, and for folks that are listening, there may be a GS-1. I have no idea if there's a GS-1, but GS-2 really is the bottom of the federal service. And so to have gone from a GS-2 to becoming a Deputy Secretary of Labor to an ambassador, I have kind of lived the full journey of federal service. So, and then my love of politics really comes from after my sophomore year in college, I had the chance to intern for my hometown senator and just loved being on Capitol Hill, and then knew at some point government service politics would always be in my blood.
That's amazing. And I love the fact that your parents inspired you that early on and that they included you in what they were doing. And it seems to have really kind of stuck with you and made an impression. So then you've had this fascinating career, and we could spend days talking about all the negotiations you've led and decisions you've influenced. And I imagine all the hours of sleep you've lost in the process. But since this is a pretty short podcast, I would love to know what or who motivated you to keep going when times got tough. What's inspired you kind of through the ups and downs of your own career?
It really is my parents. Their journey to this country was a typical immigrant journey. It wasn't as difficult as some of the people who are crossing the border right now, but they came to a country where they didn't know the language, they didn't have much money, they didn't certainly know the cultural norms. They came here to seek a better life for themselves. And during those really tough times, I always thought back to how difficult that must have been for them, to because they wanted to build a better life for them and then for their children. And I thought to myself, if they can make those sacrifices, if they can persevere through very difficult times whatever I was going through, whether it was in the West Wing, whether it was at the State Department of the UN, would never match what they had done. It really felt to me an obligation to continue serving, to continue fighting, to continue trying to make this a better country. And I believe that now more than any other time. I mean, we have unfortunately made diversity, equity, and inclusion bad words in this country for reasons that I can't quite understand. But, you know, as somebody who has often been the only Asian American at the table, or certainly the first one in many positions, I felt the special obligation as an American, but as an Asian American, to represent my community's views at the table. And I think that diversity has contributed to, I think, better policymaking. And I'm never, ever going to give up my seat at the table just because somebody, you know, makes diversity a bad term. And so I think now more than ever, I'm committed to how I can fight back, how I can continue to work on the issues and work for the kind of American values that I believe in and that my parents came to this country for.
I think that's incredible. And you're making me kind of wonder, and I'll put you on the spot here because I didn't prep you with this question, but what do you think a lot of displaced federal workers now can be doing? Because I think for those who have built their careers around service and felt called to service and felt a sense of responsibility to serve, it could be really challenging then to reorient yourself when you no longer have that career path and those opportunities to serve in the way that you've always known. So what are you doing? What do you think others can do in order to keep fighting, keep serving from a different seat?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's the immediate challenge, I think, of the hundreds of thousands of federal workers who may end up losing their jobs. It's going to be an exceedingly difficult job market, particularly here in the Washington, D.C. area, simply because, you know, the types of work that we do in government don't easily translate to the private sector. And that's no knock on what we do in government. But, you know, if you are overseeing the dispersal of foreign assistance programs at USAID, or you're working on student loan programs at the Department of Education, there's not an easy private sector analog to that. There's no other easy way to translate what you're doing. But I think for a lot of us in government, what we really do is we manage programs. And I think that is, you know, we're given a task, we're given a group of people, we're given a deadline, and we move an organization from point A to point Z. And so I think the important thing, I think, for people now is to take those public sector experiences and translate them as well as you can into the kind of work that happens in the private sector. It is going to be a challenge, and I think it's especially going to be a challenge for people who live outside the Washington, D.C. area. I mean, I think a lot of people don't understand. The vast majority of federal workers don't live in the D.C. metropolitan area. And I think in a lot of these places, a lot of these communities, particularly rural communities, where the federal government is a major employer, they're going to have a challenge, because at least here in the Washington, D.C. area, jobs that are information sector type jobs are frankly more abundant in other places. But I do think more broadly, whether you're in danger of losing your job or not in danger of losing your job, it's important to make the case about why government service and why the work of government matters. I often think one of the failings we have whenever we go through these periodic debates about a government shutdown is that we exempt all essential services from that potential shutdown. And I think when we do that, the American people don't quite understand how government impacts in the everyday lives. It's the Social Security checks, it's the veterans' health care, it's environmental protection, it's food inspection, it's the people that check your luggage at the airport, it's the air traffic controllers at the FAA. All across the board, federal government touches your lives in small ways and in very big ways. And I think most Americans don't understand that. So if you are a federal employee, I think it's incumbent upon you to help tell that story, particularly to your friends and family who are outside of Washington, because I think members of Congress really need to stand up on behalf of federal workers, and they need to hear that from their constituents out around the country. And I think, frankly, unfortunately, with the mass layoffs that are in process of happening, and I think sooner are going to happen even more, we're going to see a serious deterioration of government services. And I think that's going to be a very painful awakening for many Americans about why the government matters.
Absolutely. And I think maybe this all connects to the fact that I believe anyway that there has been a disconnect between Americans and their government that's not specific to political party or administration, but that's been kind of growing over the last couple of decades. And I think a lot of what we're seeing now is kind of a product of that sense of disconnectedness and misunderstanding of what government provides and is meant to provide to the American people. And so much of it is about storytelling, which was part of my motivation for doing this podcast. I really want Americans to understand kind of what federal workers are actually providing to them on a daily basis, but also to understand that these are human beings with lives and stories that might very closely resemble your own. And I really try to stay in touch with my upbringing. I was also raised by a family with immigrant roots. My grandfather immigrated, and my whole family was not necessarily politically connected, but certainly politically, civically engaged. And I grew up around conversations around the kitchen table, talking about, like, what does this mean? What do we expect of our government? How do we become engaged as citizens? So I think that's so important. And if we can remember that our federal workers are also just people from families in America, all coming together to try to serve, we can kind of get back to valuing government service a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, look, when we have a natural disaster in this country, we are used to calling on federal agencies like FEMA to step in and provide the immediate response to people affected and then help with the rebuilding efforts. And that's a very tangible way that the federal government impacts people's lives. But I think sometimes what they forget before then, and we're seeing this play out, it is NOAA, which is the agency within the federal government that helps with weather observation. These layoffs are going to hit NOAA right now. So that is going to affect our ability to better see and predict weather patterns that can allow people to evacuate more quickly from danger areas. That's not an area that the American people see very often. Obviously, the existential issue of our day is climate change, and the people who are working at EPA and other agencies who are helping not only to reduce carbon emissions, but also better predict the areas that are more likely to flood. All of that stuff happens behind the scenes that can actually avert some of these disasters before they hit. Those are not the things that the federal, that most people around the country really understand. And we need to tell that story much better.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then kind of stepping back for a second from the services that federal employees provide, how have you throughout your career been able to separate your identity from your work? Have you ever struggled with that? Because I think so many federal employees now suddenly displaced might be having a challenge with that. And I know that when I left the State Department, I felt a little bit lost, especially because when you choose a career based on a sense of duty and purpose and you go through quite a bit to get there, it can be hard to separate yourself from that. So I'm wondering how you've preserved your sense of self.
And it's tragic right now. I mean, as somebody who spends way too much time online, on social media, I see these just stories of really dejected, discouraged, traumatized federal employees who thought that they were going to spend their lives at this agency working on this issue that they love that helps the American people. And now that sense of identity, that sense of purpose has been missing. I do think going forward, and we could debate whether this is good or bad, government as a lifetime job is, I think, something that will probably be a thing of the past. And so I think increasingly people are going to have to get used to moving in and out of government, into the private sector, into nonprofit world, or moving among different agencies. That's certainly easier in certain sectors than others. I mean, in the world that you and I come in the State Department, it's not like there's an easy analog in the private sector, and there certainly are nonprofits that we could go to, international organizations. I would also say this, I mean, I've been, you know, my 20 some years in government, I have been a political appointee either on Capitol Hill or in the executive branch for that entire period of time. So I'm unfortunately kind of used to this every 2, 4, or 8 years potentially being out of a job. It is an incredible honor to serve. But I think in part because I have been displaced in previous presidential transitions, I've learned, I think, in some place, separate what I do in the office and my own personal identity. Although at heart, I'm a civil servant, I'm a public servant, I believe in what this is. I will say this, because as a political appointee, by nature, your term in office can be short. I've always tried to make the most of this opportunity, never really let time go to waste, because I'm never really sure when this opportunity will end. I'm also always thinking about, in particular, the last couple of jobs I've had that have been higher profile out in front. People are very nice to you when you're an ambassador. People are very nice to you when you're the Deputy Secretary of Labor or when you work in the White House. I've always understood they're nice to me because of my position and not necessarily who I am as a person. And so I never let that get to my head. I know that the minute you lose that title, many of those invitations go away. And I'm always very grateful when I still get those invitations and I know who is really my friend. So there has been, and I've seen, this humbling aspect that I've had to go through. It also sort of speaks to, as somebody who moves in and out of government often, look, in life you should be nice to everybody, particularly when you're in politics, you're in government service, you should be nice to everybody, because you're never so good that you can't return somebody's phone call, so never so important you can't be nice to other people, because trust me, when you're on the outside looking back in, all those people you were nice to will actually return your phone calls when you need them.
It's so true. And also, for our listeners, I can attest to this because I was just a low-level peon planning an event at the State Department last year, and Ambassador Chris Liu was an attendee at that event, and he was one of the only people who pulled me aside and said, hey, thank you for all the work that you put into this, and please let me know if I can ever help you. And that stuck in my mind, and I think that kind of humility and decency is such an important part of leadership and certainly a hallmark of his leadership. So
it's true. It's very nice. I would also say this, as somebody who spent my first 12 years of public service on Capitol Hill, you get used to seeing people who answered the phone or were the driver for the senator who 5 years later become a chief of staff somewhere. So, politics, government is a meritocracy. And so you actually really should be nice to the most junior people because you may be working for them someday.
It's so true. And so actually that leads me into my next question, which is, what do you think people misunderstand about public servants and about public service? And what would you like to correct for the record?
First of all, we don't get paid a lot. And as somebody who, my benchmark is I started my career as a lawyer. As a U.S. ambassador, I made less money than a first-year law student, a lawyer coming out of law school at a major law firm in New York or D.C. or somewhere else. So the pay is not good. So we certainly don't do this for the pay. And the work is really hard. You know, I think about the times in my career when I was at the White House in 2009 to 2013, the initial part was, how do we get the country out of the Great Recession? Then how do we get the Affordable Care Act passed? And then after that, how do we get the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare implemented along the way? Getting programs passed and getting programs implemented is exceedingly difficult. And I've seen that in so many different contexts. When I was the Deputy Secretary of Labor, one of the big programs that the Department of Labor oversees is the unemployment insurance system for all 50 states. In normal times when the economy is good, that really doesn't come into play. But you think about in 2020 during the height of COVID, when you have millions of people out of job and they were flooding the state systems to apply for unemployment insurance, or what you're very likely going to see in the next couple of months with federal layoffs, you want that system to work well. And making sure that people get their benefits as quickly as they've earned them and that you've minimized the amount of waste and fraud is very, very hard. Or I think about my work at the United Nations on behalf of the State Department. A lot of people who are not familiar with the United Nations think we're always voting on things. And we don't actually vote on that many things at the United Nations. It all operates on consensus. So, look, I've spent my career in Washington, and trying to get Democrats and Republicans to agree on anything is hard. Getting to the United Nations, that was like a whole different a beast. I mean, trying to get 193 countries to agree on anything mm-hmm. is really, really hard. And it requires talking to countries that the United States typically does not talk to. It's about standing up for your positions and your values, but also understanding others' positions and trying to find some common ground. And so government and making government work well is really hard. And so that misconception is that federal workers don't do anything. They get paid a lot of money. It's just, it's not true. I won't curse. It's not true. and I wish more people, and look, on the scale of things that government employees do, my job is not even that difficult. I'm not out there on the front line of doing research into pandemics. I'm not trying to make help man go to the moon or Mars. I mean, those are exceedingly hard jobs. But even at my level, making government work well, very, very hard.
It is very hard. And you're reminding me of my time working on UN Security Council issues. And I think the biggest surprise to me there was the fact that sometimes it's much harder to land on a position we can all agree on within our own government than it is to negotiate that position with 14 other countries on the Security Council, you know, to have their feedback come back into our system and have to renegotiate over and over and over within our own system was extremely challenging, but also a part of arriving at the right answer. And so it's a necessary tension and a necessary challenge.
I would also say this, I mean, it's a really great point. I think maybe the other misconception is that the U.S. government is not one monolithic entity. One of the things that you and I had to spend a lot of time with is the quote-unquote interagency process. Mm-hmm. And part of this is trying to get the dozens of federal agencies that have interests, equities in any particular U.S. policy, getting them all aligned. And different agencies have different priorities, and that's as it should be. And they're standing up for the programs that they put forward, their positions that they put forward. And synthesizing all of that into one government position is an amazingly time-consuming process.
It is. And it also brings me back to the important role of career civil service officers who have decades of expertise and can look at an issue differently than a political appointee who's newer to the issue and also provides value in having a fresh perspective. And that conversation needs to happen. And that expertise is really what allows us to kind of place parameters on our decision-making processes and make sure that we have the right information being fed into the decision-making process.
You know, and it's such an important point because I remember in the jobs I've had, and it's in complete contrast to what is happening under this current administration, I lean heavily on career civil servants. Because I guarantee you, every new idea you have, every new program you want to roll out, the civil servants have seen this before. And they will candidly tell you, hey, here's what's been tried in the past. Here's why it hasn't worked. Or if you really want to do this, you might want to try this instead. That institutional knowledge is critical. Now, look, part of our job as political appointees to continue to push the envelope, mm-hmm. To try to do things that have not been done before. But if you fire all of those civil servants, you lose that memory that just tells you, and it just that tells you what can work, and it's just going to make your task much more difficult. And I think this current administration is going to find that. Look, they're moving very aggressively on so many different areas. Truthfully, if they actually were more smart about this, they would have kept the federal civil servants who could better help them implement their policies.
Right. Fully agree. So then, kind of switching gears, in an entirely different universe, if you hadn't gone into politics, what do you think you would have done with your life?
So I will admit my first love was journalism. I was in college at Princeton. I would love to tell you I learned a lot in the classroom, but I didn't. I spent most of my time as a reporter and then later as an editor at the Daily Princetonian, which is a daily newspaper run by students, which is kind of remarkable because there's not that much news going on in Princeton, New Jersey, and that we managed to put out a daily newspaper. And that's where I basically learned how to ask hard questions, how to write quickly, how to analyze problems, how to work under deadline. And right during my senior year of college, I really wanted to go and work for a newspaper. My parents basically, as immigrants said, yeah, you're not going to do that. You have to go get a graduate degree. And, I was a dopey liberal arts major. And so what else was I going to do but go to law school? So I went to law school. In hindsight, obviously, look, given the nature of the journalism industry, it probably was not the worst decision not to have pursued that career. But I still think about that now in terms of both my appreciation for the hard work that the press does, but also even as simply as how do I tell a story? How do I brief one of my superiors, one of my principals on what's happening? I really think about it in the way that a newspaper person would tell a story quickly and help people understand things.
Yeah, and I think storytelling is one of the most valuable skills today, and also something that, we didn't even get into talking about AI. You did so much work on the AI resolution, but thinking about how AI is going to replace some of the functions that human beings have been doing, but how there's this human component to understanding how to leverage AI and how to tell the stories that need to be told that I think will not disappear anytime soon.
No, and I think as we move into this next phase of where government goes, there's so much conversation about potential budget cuts coming down the road. And I think, when we talk about, for instance, potentially $880 billion of Medicaid cuts, that number just doesn't mean anything to the American people. So here's what you need to explain. Here's how many people will lose health care. Here's what it means in terms of the ability of rural hospitals to stay in business. The ability to pay doctors in areas that don't have a lot of doctors, and what that means specifically for people in certain areas. And you're right, it's the storytelling. AI does a great job of synthesizing information, but humans can tell that story much better.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I feel like I could talk to you all day, and I have so many questions about your experiences in your past, but I just wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me today. Your career is inspiring, but truly it's your decency and your humility that have always stood out to me. So thank you for your service, and I really look forward to seeing what you do next.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure being on the podcast, and I wish you the best with this. We need to tell the stories of public service much more and much better, and so I'm happy to support your efforts.
Thank you.